Previously on Beta.
No reason to become alarmed, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your flight.
By the way, is there anyone on board who knows how to fly a plane?
Five fights, huh? Rocky Marciano's got 40 and he's a millionaire.
That's true.
That is true.
Oh, God, why are you doing this?
It's cheaper than a movie and this free coffee.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Javier Grillo Marks Watch takes us inside the life of a television writer and showrunner.
A showrunner is not just a head writer. A showrunner is the CEO of a corporation with 150 employees and a multi-million dollar budget.
Also, novelist Juliet Escoria reveals how she has found some joy and peace in the wake of her battle with mental illness.
Getting sober helped a lot. I did the thing where you sit in church basements with other people. You know, you really have to work hard if you want to be okay with that.
But first, Chuck Klosterman. He's the pop culture critic known for books like Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and his memoir about growing up in North Dakota, Fargo, Rock City. His latest book is called Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. I had the chance to catch up with Chuck when he was in Milwaukee promoting his book, and he explained what he means by fictional nonfiction.
It almost seems consciously confusing, and it probably is, but you know, if you think about it, if you turned it around and it was called nonfictional fiction, it would still be fiction.
So what is the distinction between the two? Because I wondered about that.
Okay. It was typically in these situations, they just put stories at the bottom of the book. And I was like, I don't want to do that. So I sort of came up with this inside joke to myself, which of course is a questionable move to make. But there is one aspect of it, I suppose, that might be reflective of something that has meaning, and is that this is not a criticism of other fiction writers, but I typically don't like the way fiction is written.
Why?
A whole bunch of reasons. I mean, I tend to read almost exclusively nonfiction, partially for the practicality of it. You know, it's like the difference between a documentary film and a feature film. If they're both bad, it's still worthwhile to watch the documentary. You might get some information. In reading, if you read something that's non-fictional, but it doesn't matter how enjoyable it is, it's like you still might get something from it. That's part of it. But also, I think the bigger thing is, you know, nonfiction is written in a straightforward way where the principal goal is to communicate ideas. And very often in fiction, particularly modern literary fiction, the emphasis is on the structure of the prose and sort of the experience that's supposed to be edifying is the unpacking of that. This is written like nonfiction. So these are untrue stories, but I wrote them the exact same way I would have written stories if I had been told about a real event.
That makes sense. Yeah, and because they're so idea-driven.
Exactly.
Yeah, you want them to write them as nonfiction.
Because that's the other thing. Like,
yes.
Traditionally, they always say, like, if we were at a creative writing workshop, they would always say, you know, you start with character, and then you move to plot mechanics, and from that comes the idea. Mm-hmm. And I kind of work in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I start with the idea. The characters are character types.
Yeah.
Their job is to sort of exist within this created reality. The plot is less important than the concept.
Yeah. Many of the 34 stories in this book struck me as kind of a combination of Twilight Zone episodes and thought experiments. Was that something you were kind of going for with this?
I mean, that's definitely where I ended up. Like, if someone asked me, what are these stories like? I think comparing it to The Twilight Zone or Black Mirror would be the most sensible thing. Was I going for it? I'm not sure, because I didn't have total clarity of like what the idea of like how it was supposed to be as a whole when I started. But, you know, much like The Twilight Zone, where you watch an episode, and if we were talking about the original Twilight Zone, for example, we'd remember, oh, you know, William Shatner was in this episode, or Burgess Meredith, or we might remember certain stories, but what we'd really be talking about is kind of the world that was built for every episode. The idea that, like, it's set in reality with one thing different, or the idea of time has shifted or something like that. That is what these stories are like to me.
Raised in Captivity seems like such a creative departure from all your previous books. What were you trying to do different with this book?
I was a little embarrassed to talk about this because the answer will make me seem like kind of a lunatic, but it's the true thing. Okay. So I wanted to do this for a while, for probably 5 years. Anytime I had like a strange premise or like a kind of a, you know, like an interesting bit of dialogue I thought or overheard or whatever, the idea of a certain kind of character, I would put it into the notes app of my phone. Okay. So I had hundreds and hundreds of these. And then I came to what I thought was a brilliant decision. I'm going to use these ideas to write 100 stories that are exactly 1,000 words long. The entire thing was going to be 1,000 word stories, exactly 1,000. So I started doing that. And I did that a few times. I wrote a few stories and made sure they were exactly 1,000 words. But then I started to realize a few things. First thing I realized is all the stories were either being stretched up to 1,000 or cut down to 1,000. So every story was at an unnatural length. Then it occurred to me that this book would also be edited and copy edited. So I'd have to go back in and add words or subtract words once again to get it back to this mystical 1,000 word length. And then I just finally realized, this is stupid. What, who's going to care? Like, no one reads a book because the stories are the same length. It's like, yeah, I don't even know why I thought that was so interesting. I mean, I do like the idea of obstructions in writing. And I do also feel like, because I had this secondary goal to begin with that was I was so conscious of, it probably did make me write faster and get more into it. Like, because the initial stories, you know, it's always hard to start sometimes when you're starting a new project, but I wasn't even thinking of the content. I was thinking like, I got to make sure this idea is compact enough to fit in this space. So that was the original conception. It would be 100 stories of 1,000 words, but now there are 34 stories of whatever length they're supposed to be.
Yeah, I think you made the right decision. And I'm wondering, I think maybe the reason you got sort of kind of fixated originally on wanting to do this was because as far as we know, it probably hasn't been done.
Well, I mean, possibly, I guess. Yeah. I just thought it would be interesting. But, you know, it's interesting to someone for 40 seconds. Like, you know, even within that first minute, they're like, well, okay, that math thing was interesting that you did or whatever. Like, now why? And I'm like, oh, but they're 1,000 words. They're all 1,000 words. Like, that's all I'd be able to say about all of them.
Yeah, yeah. And instead of the usual head and shoulders about the author photo on the dust jacket, you did something different. You went to the Center for Medical Imaging in Hillsboro, Oregon, and had an x-ray taken of your head. My theory is that you did this because you wanted to convey the idea that you're giving us kind of exclusive inside access to the way your mind works and what being Chuck Klosterman is really like. Is that the case?
Maybe that's 1% of it.
Okay. What's
maybe another? 4% is that the title Raised in Captivity, I'm really talking about my brain, which I feel was raised in captivity. I don't feel like I necessarily have agency over how I think and feel. I don't think anyone does. I think that in a mediated culture, we have it. It's very difficult to know how you think or feel about anything. 95% of it, though, was that we had the cover art for the book and the back cover, which were both these kind of illustrations of skeletons. And I thought, like, well, what if my author photo was my actual skull? And I gotta say, it is more complicated to get a x-ray of your skull for no reason than you might think. You got to go to your doctor, explain that you want this. She has to recommend you to, like, the imaging center. They had a lot of questions when I showed up, like, because they kept saying, it's like, well, there's nothing on here about what we're looking for. And in fact, it seems to suggest that you can tell us what you want to have x-rayed. Like, as is probably true, this had never happened to them before, that someone had came in for just a x-ray for aesthetics.
Yeah. So did you have to foot the bill for it?
Yep, $106 it cost.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? That seems cheap. That's a good deal on that. Can you tell me a bit about the title story, Raised in Captivity?
Raised in Captivity as a story. I've had a real fortunate life. You know, I can't sort of believe how things have worked out for me. And sometimes I feel real strange about it. And in the story, it's about someone who got a job and now they're flying first class. And they kind of sense that just being in first class somehow indicates that they're a different person now. And then they go to the bathroom and there is a puma in the lavatory. So he goes back and he talks to the rich guy sitting next to him. And to me, it's sort of about the confusion over class when you move from one class to another. Like, so often when people talk about socioeconomics and class, we operate almost as if a person exists in one tier of society and that is who they are forever. But people are always shifting this. You know, I was born probably, I guess, technically lower class. I lived a big part of my life middle class. Now I'm sure from a, like, if according to the IRS or whatever, I'm kind of living in the upper class or whatever. And so I feel like I do have a sense of how the economics of your reality do shape who you are. And that's kind of what the story is about. Now, to the person who reads it, it'll be like, this is just weird, but hopefully it's weird in a way that's entertaining.
Oh, it definitely is. And the class thing didn't register with me, but now that you've mentioned it, I've read the story a couple times, it makes sense. And my favorite section in this story occurs shortly after your protagonist has returned to his seat and he's talking to the older, richer guy sitting next to him about seeing the puma in the bathroom. And the older man asks the protagonist to theorize about how the puma ended up there. Would you mind reading an excerpt from this section?
Sure, okay. The two men looked into each other's eyes, hunching their shoulders and leaning closer. The interaction adopted a conspiratorial tone. They spoke in stage whispers. The other passengers barely noticed and didn't care. "Tell me this," said the older man. "What are your theories?" "My theories?" "In terms of how this could have happened." "I have no idea," the younger man said. "I have no theories." "Try," said the older man. "We're just brainstorming. There are no wrong answers." This was not what the younger man had expected to hear, but he had no expectations at all, so it wasn't awkward or off-putting. He did what he was told. "I suppose it's possible that some millionaire might own a puma as an exotic pet, and he was hauling it across the country and it escaped from its cage in the cargo hold and crawled through the air conditioning vents, and it somehow ended up in the bathroom." "Excellent," said the older man. "Let's have another." "I don't know. Maybe it prowled down from the Hollywood Hills and ended up at LAX, and it was drawn into the airplane hangar by the warmth of the cooling jet engines, but it got scared when the engines were restarted and scampered into the only cave-like crevice it could find, which was the restroom inside the aircraft." "Less plausible," said the older man, "but still possible. Keep going." "Well, maybe this is a psychological experiment, and the puma is a trained puma, and I'm being watched. Maybe this is some kind of radical research project. And maybe you're the scientist who came up with the experiment, which is why you're seated next to me and asking these questions." "That's compelling," said the older man. "But let me assure you, if this is a research project, I'm not part of it."
This whole section kind of strikes me as if it's kind of a writer's commentary track, because you're giving us access to your creative process and the questions that I imagine occurred to you while you were writing the story. Is that fair to say?
Well, I'm sure it is. Because, you know, when did I first think of this story? Well, in one sense, I probably don't know exactly, but it feels like I was probably on an airplane waiting to use the bathroom. And at one point I was like, what if I open that door and there's a puma in there? And then I started thinking, well, how could that happen, you know?
Yeah. This is the first book that you've written since you've moved from New York to Portland, Oregon in 2017. Is there something about moving from New York to the Pacific Northwest that has played a part in your writing this different kind of book?
You know, it must, because the only perspective you have is yours. So if you change everything about what you're experiencing through that perspective, it's going to shift. I do feel like, you know, when I lived in New York, I was probably overstimulated. Like, you know, you can't really live in New York and not constantly be encountering different people, different ideas. You know, the world is almost changing in front of you and with you. But now, there are many days where the only people I talk to are my wife, my kids, and maybe my kid's teacher, or maybe somebody who works at a diner or something. I'm much more inside my mind. There's more time where I'm by myself. And even though, I mean, it's odd because I've written a bunch of memoirs, but this feels like the most personal book I've done, because I really feel like it's about my interior life, where so many of the other books I wrote were about my exterior life.
Mm-hmm. In the acknowledgments, you thank anyone who has ever caused you to have a weird thought, which makes me wonder, who's the person? Is there a friend or a writer or a musician that has caused you to have the most weird thoughts in your life?
Now, that's a good question. The person who has made me have the most weird thoughts.
Yes.
you know, probably my wife.
Yeah.
She would be number one. I had some friends in college. One guy named Rex, one guy named Mr. Pancake, one guy named Mike. We had a lot of weird thoughts together. I had some friends in New York, a girl I used to hang out with. We used to party together. She was weird. I don't really know. It probably is my wife, just from the pure magnitude of times we have talked about things by ourselves, just like sitting in the bedroom watching television.
A lot of these stories deal with ethics and morality. I'm thinking especially of the story Pain is a Concept by Which We Measure Our God, in which a couple considers getting a medical implant that will transfer the pain of childbirth from the woman to her husband. I'm curious, did the idea for this story come out of the time you spent writing the ethicist column for the New York Times magazine?
No, that came out of just something that I have thought about for a while, which is, what are the responsibilities of loving someone? Like, once you make a commitment that you love someone, what are sort of the collective shared responsibilities we all have? And sometimes it seems like one of those things is the active willingness to accept your partner's pain and discomfort, you know, with your spouse, but also your kids or even your friends. Within the context of this story, it's like, okay, so there's a social pressure that if this existed, if it was possible for men to take away the pain of childbirth and they would feel it, the wife would be able to sort of use this device that would jump all the pain to the guy, there would be a huge amount of social pressure to do that. It would be perceived as incredibly unmasculine not to, you know. But in this story, like, the guy agrees to do this, and as you're filling out the paperwork, he starts getting these secondary thoughts, like, you know, he's like, how do we know it's not supposed to be this way? Like, how do we know that pain isn't supposed to be part of childbirth, you know? And the wife is like, well, why would that be? Like, why would there be some sort of natural order to this? And he's like, I don't know. It's like, you know, so I don't think it came out of doing the ethicist, but, you know, I mean, now that you're mentioning it, I suppose a lot of these stories may have fragments back from that period because, mm-hmm. you know, that was a time when I was thinking about ethical problems constantly. And in life, you always are, but I was thinking about ethical problems that didn't even apply to me. So there might be some residue of that.
Chuck Klosterman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Chuck Klosterman is a pop culture critic and the author of 12 books. His latest is Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. Find out more about Chuck at wpr.org/beta.
And to a lot of showrunners, that means whatever pain I have to drag myself through, whatever psychosis I have to relive, whatever trauma of my childhood I have to revisit on myself, I get to revisit on others so that they may suffer as I have, and that's how the show's going to get made.
TV writer and producer Javier Grillo Marks Watch on the toxic culture that lies behind many television shows. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Honestly, darling, I love you.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Chizing, please help me. Please come get me.
It's a distress call. Plea for help, a mayday. If the count is right, it's been playing over and over for 16 years.
Someone else stranded here?
Guys, where are we?
That's a clip from the ABC TV series Lost, which debuted in 2004. And for those of you who have been stranded on your own mysterious island for the past 15 years and haven't seen it, let me tell you, Lost is a groundbreaking show about a group of plane crash survivors who find themselves stranded in the South Pacific. Javier Grillo Marks Watch worked as a writer and producer on Lost for the show's first two seasons. He writes about his experiences in a book called Shoot That One. Javier tells us why the first season of Lost was such a breakout hit.
And one of the reasons that the show turned out the way it did is that there wasn't a lot of time to second guess anything on it. It was a massive leap of faith in JJ and in Damon that ABC ordered the pilot, because they quite literally ordered it off of an outline. There had been a previous script in development with this premise, and then the script wasn't well received, so they threw out the script. And around January, around the time when most pilots have been written and picked over for 6 months and they're getting picked to go to film, was when JJ and Damon turned in this outline. We were racing to get the show done. We were writing. We were casting off of the same sides for different characters. We were buying the fuselage of an L-1011 before there was like a complete script and sending it to Hawaii. So it was one of those things where it was all done in this heat of the moment in a way that I think caught a strange kind of alchemy. It caught a strange kind of lightning in a bottle. All of these very talented people suddenly being thrown into this extraordinarily high-pressure situation. And I think this is one of those cases where, you know, the development process, I've seen development work really well. I've seen it create great hit shows. I was at NBC as an executive the year that ER was developed, and that was a show that benefited enormously from traditional network development. And yet, this is a show that completely came out of left field, and somehow that magic happened. And I think part of it was that there was just no time to second guess what we were doing. We sat in a room for months trying to come up with a mythology for the show and all of that. We went through all the crappy ideas. We came up with some good ones, threw them in. And ultimately what came out of all of that chaos was this little sort of jewel. You know, I'm proud of it because when you think about the way that TV drama has existed traditionally, like you're talking about 24 episodes or 22 episodes a year, you know, and they're all anthologized and all of this stuff. And we were working in a paradigm that was, you know, a little bit of both. The network expected us to do a story of the week show. We knew we wanted it to be serialized, and there was this tension going on there. We had to do 22 of them. It wasn't like now where you can do 10 or 13 and call it a season, you know? So for me, part of the pride I feel on that is that we were able to take a very traditional model of network storytelling and turn it on its head completely.
We need to push the button.
No, we don't.
Did you not hear me, brother? I crashed your bloody plane.
How did you manage to do that?
On that day, those numbers turned to hieroglyphics. And when the last one came down, this whole place started to shake. And that screen filled up with system failure. System failure. And that number there, 92204, September the 22nd, 2004. The day your plane crashed is real. It's all bloody real. Now push the damn button.
I know what I saw. It's a lie. It's not real. None of it is real.
You don't want to push the button, then I will.
No.
I worked on a show called Boomtown a few years earlier, and I think that that's the closest that any traditional network show had come before Lost to really just taking the tropes and, you know, putting them in a bucket full of stones and shaking it up and seeing what came out the other side, you know?
Yeah. Can you give me a few examples of some of the ideas that you and the other members of the Lost think tank came up with?
Well, look, the biggest one is this. The pilot had these micro flashbacks to the airplane, right?
Yeah.
And one of the ways that we thought we would really, really get in the heads of these characters was by creating these very detailed backstories for them, you know? Mm-hmm. And those were very much crafted by those four writers in that room. You know, we sort of ran ideas by JJ and Damon, and then we would get in there and would really dig in very deep. And it came to a point where we were trying to break stories for the show. We just kept hitting these roadblocks, you know, because, for example, like episode 2, we had this marshal. We knew we wanted to kill the marshal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great story. We knew it was going to be a euthanasia story, all of this stuff. And we knew that him and Kate were going to have a backstory. And then the B story for that episode was like Hurley digs a latrine or something. It was really lame. And we realized that it's hard to come up with a number of compelling stories that are going to carry the equal dramatic weight while being serialized and all that. And it was during that point, and this was like before the upfronts. I mean, we're talking about May. So, you know, the show is expected to be understood by its creators as what it's going to be. And within that think tank, we came up with this idea, hey, the pilot has flashbacks. Why don't we do flashbacks in the series?
Your father's told us all about you.
Yeah, what's he told you about me? What'd you tell him about me, Dad? That your son never really had it. Not like the old man. I didn't have the will to make it work. My life, my job, my marriage. What'd you tell him about my marriage, Dad? You know how he manages his marriage? A bottle of scotch every night before dinner.
And it was one of those things where, like, literally minds exploded, and we took all of that detail that we had built up over months of brainstorming and made it part of the series.
You have this great story that you tell in Shoot That One about an incident that occurred in your neighborhood dog park.
Yeah.
Can you share that story with us?
Well, you know, it's like people ask, when did you know Lost was huge or all of that? For me, the biggest sort of version of the power of Lost that I can give you is, so I go to my dog park, and there was this very nice guy who had this dog who was dying of acute canine leukemia. He was a very nice man. You know, his dog was just a sack of bones. I mean, he literally was like a bag of brown fur holding a bunch of bones, and the dog was very tired and very sick. But the guy every day would bring the dog in, and, you know, I got to know him, and I got to know the dog, and he'd let the dog play, and then every once in a while, the dog would just sort of conk out and just lie on the ground. But he would sit there with his dog, and, you know, I'm sitting at the park bench with him for a moment, you know, and we're talking about the dog, and I'm like, look, I'm really sorry, because I'd seen this guy for weeks, you know, and he goes like, yeah, I'm sorry too. And I said, you know, he's not just a great dog, he has a great owner. And then the guy broke down, and then I cried, and then we cried, and then we stopped crying, and there was this awkward moment where we're sitting across this bench from each other, and all we know from each other is that, you know, he has a dying dog, and I'm very sympathetic to his cause. So out of this awkward moment, he says, what do you do for a living? And I said, oh, I'm one of the writers of Lost. And literally his eyes saucered out, and he shouts, he goes like, oh my God, can you tell me what's happening on that island? And I was like, yep, the power of Lost right there. You know, I mean, look, I'm happy that we took his mind off of something awful that was going on in his life. And it was really validating for me that even in this tragedy, you know, the guy was so excited about the show.
After Lost, you worked as a co-executive producer for the supernatural drama Medium, starring Patricia Arquette, and then you executive produced and created your own TV series called The Middleman.
That's correct.
Can you tell me about The Middleman? Middleman.
Well, The Middleman was a script I wrote in 1998, and my agent hated it, and my ex-wife hated it, and I divorced my ex-wife. I kept my agent. But, you know, it was one of those scripts. I had written it as a response to a lot of the shows that were on TV, because there was this sort of trope in the 90s that heroism destroyed your life, you know? Buffy's mom died. Buffy's boyfriend is a vampire who has no soul. Every superhero show in the late 90s seemed to be coming out of the darkness of the 80s into a greater darkness that implied that heroism was a life-destroying pursuit and a huge sacrifice. You know, in my experience, doing the right thing usually reaps a lot of benefits, and I wanted to write a show, you know, that was optimistic and all of that, and I did. And, you know, ultimately, because of a guy that I met in the Lost think tank, a guy named Paul Dini, who was very big in independent comics and also in DC Comics. He was the creator of Harley Quinn, for example.
Didn't he work on the Batman animated series, too?
Absolutely. He was one of the writers of that, and he was a huge voice in that world. And he sort of coached me through how to do an independent comic. So, you know, I found an artist who was wonderful, a guy named Les McLean. We put together a pitch. We sold the comic book. It was published by a comic book company. And then around the time that I left Lost, around the time I was doing Medium, I started shopping it to TV networks. And ABC Family, which has since transformed itself into Freeform, took it on. And I remember saying things to them like, guys, the pilot features a gorilla with a machine gun. And they're like, yeah, we know. And I'm like, it's not a metaphorical gorilla. It's a real gorilla in a tracksuit with a machine gun. And they're like, we know. And I'm like, are you sure you want to make this show? And they're like, yep. And I'm like, wow, I found my network, you know?
Get your filthy paws off of me, you damn dirty ape!
And people always ask me, like, why would you do a show about zombie fish and crazy sort of Mexican wrestlers?
Why is my car being surrounded by a bunch of Lucha Libre wrestlers?
That is a very long story for another day, my impudent young weasel.
And ghost sorority sisters and things like that, you know, at ABC Family. It seemed like that was the really wrong venue for it. And I'm like, no, it wasn't, because they let me make a show as bat insane as that, you know?
The premise is very intriguing. The title character, he's like a freelance fixer of exotic problems.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about
that? It's basically Gilmore Girls meets Men in Black. You try to get in a situation when you create characters where the characters have a huge core conflict that could drive the show forever. And this was a girl who was an artist who was snarky, you know, had a lot in common with, like, Daria, that kind of character. And she winds up working a job with the world's squarest square that ever squared. The middleman was literally Joe Friday.
You know how in comic books there's all kinds of mad scientists and aliens and androids and monsters?
In comic books, sure.
Well, it really does work like that.
And you're the superhero?
I never wear tights.
And he owes a lot to Joe Friday, as essayed by Dan Aykroyd in Dragnet. I just wanted to create a show that had an airframe that could support every absurd thing that we could imagine within the rubric of, this is the guy who takes care of keeping reality normal. And it's one of those things, you know, people always say, like, oh, aren't you sad it got canceled after 12 episodes, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm shocked we got to make the thing in the first place, you know? And I'm shocked that it exists as a DVD. People can find it. You know, it's out there.
Yeah. Your latest book, Shoot That One, contains the mean version of the 11 laws of show running.
Yes, the mean version.
Yeah. And in this essay, you attack the toxic culture that runs rampant behind many TV series. Can you talk a little bit about the toxicity that you've experienced working in TV and why you feel it was important to speak out and write about it?
Yeah, look, on its most subjective level, it boils down to this. TV writers are not known for their managerial acuity or their willingness to share. Writing tends to be a solitary job. It tends to be a job that mystifies itself. It tends to be a job that, look, a lot of us writers are clinical depressives. We have daddy issues or mommy issues or teacher issues or whoever abused us when we were kids. We come into writing with a great deal of baggage. And the hardest part for writers to divest themselves of is the notion that the negative traits in their personality, their monsters, their demons, all the things that run around their heads when the lights go out, we have to accept that those are not the things that drive our creativity, you know? And one of the things that happens when you take a writer and you make him a showrunner or her a showrunner is not just a head writer. A showrunner is the CEO of a corporation with 150 employees and a multi-million dollar budget. And it has a job which is to turn in anywhere from 10 to 22 artisanally created pieces of art. A showrunner needs to be the benign leader of that organization. And what a lot of showrunners mistakenly believe is that by being given a series that the world has validated their, quote, process, unquote, you know? And to a lot of showrunners, that means whatever pain I have to drag myself through, whatever psychosis I have to relive, whatever trauma of my childhood I have to revisit on myself, I get to revisit on others so that they may suffer as I have, and that's how the show's going to get made. And it's just not true. And honestly, the television industry is very results-driven, so they don't care how many writers are abused. You know, and look, the Me Too era, under the rubric of a lot of the sexism that's also rampant, has exposed just how much a lot of showrunners just think that it's all about them and just think that because they have this vision that they can basically do whatever they want. And that's just not the case. It is the case a lot of the time, actually. It's normal for it to be the case, but it shouldn't be. We should be in the business of teaching other artists to be great artists and then letting them be great artists.
You mentioned the Me Too movement, and that was a question I wanted to ask you. Are things getting any better in TV writers' rooms in the wake of the Me Too movement?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they are, and I think they aren't. I keep getting asked the question, and it's a really interesting question because as a Latino, I also get this a lot. It's like, when is it going to be over? When will there be enough representation? And my answer is always this. There will have been enough representation when a female writer or a person of color writer doesn't remember a time when they felt unrepresented, you know? I'm not going to ever feel that there's enough representation because I remember growing up in a media environment where Puerto Ricans were drug dealers and then slowly we worked our way up being the sidekick who gets killed by the villain to show that the bad guy means business and to galvanize the white protagonist. Look, they finally got a Puerto Rican in Star Wars and what does he do? Ruin it for everybody. I mean, you know, I hear Benicio's in Star Wars. Yeah. Oh my God, that's awesome. Oh, he betrayed everybody because he's a nihilist. That's great. And that's looking at it through my lens of having have this experience of not watching myself represented. Someday there'll be a Puerto Rican kid or a Puerto Rican man my age writing for television who goes, yeah, of course you have Puerto Rican leads on TV. And that's when there'll be enough. And I think with Me Too, it's the same thing. When will the movement end? The movement ends when literally the last person dies who remembers being sexually harassed in the workplace and not being sexually harassed in the workplace is the norm. Is it getting better? Yeah. And then it gets worse. And then it gets better. And then it gets a little better. And then it gets a lot worse. And then it lurches forward a little bit. It'll never be fast enough and it'll never be enough change. But, you know, we'll get there because I have to believe, as Dr. King said, that the arc of the universe bends toward morality. I just might not be alive to see it. That doesn't mean we can just stop.
Javier Grillo Marx-Watch is a television writer, producer, and showrunner. He's also the author of Shoot That One. Find out more about Javier and his upcoming shows at WPR.org/beta.
And then there's a scene in the book where she sees skulls coming out of the wall. And that was based on what had happened to me in class, which was very alarming if you're sitting in class and all of a sudden you start seeing skulls coming out of the wall.
Juliet Escoria talks about her debut novel, Juliet the Maniac. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Juliet Escoria's debut novel is called Juliet the Maniac. It's about a 14-year-old honor student named Juliet, whose life is derailed by drug use, self-harm, and bipolar disorder. These are all issues that Juliet herself has struggled with in real life. which raises the question of why she decided to write this book as a novel rather than a memoir.
I get that question kind of a lot, and it's strange because I didn't really think of it as anything but a novel. I'm not entirely sure why. It's kind of funny because genre doesn't really matter, but you tell yourself you're writing fiction or you tell yourself you're writing nonfiction. I always enjoy thinking that I'm writing fiction more. Like, I feel like there's less rules and I'm not confined to stick to the truth. And kind of my natural inclination when writing is to just make stuff up when I feel like it. And I just prefer reading novels to memoir as well. So probably some bias that isn't necessarily logical for writing a novel. But mostly it was so that I wouldn't be stuck to the truth and I could make things up if I wanted to kind of like illustrate something.
Yeah, so you'd have more creative freedom to not have to stick to the truth and make things up. Yeah, and I kind of thought that was one of the reasons. I also wondered if another reason maybe would be because you're revisiting such painful, harrowing memories. By writing it as a novel, did it make it less painful to have to go back and deal with this?
I don't think so. I mean, this was a very difficult book to write in a lot of ways. I mean, I do think there is some sort of safety, a bit of feeling of safety by calling it fiction. And I feel like if people don't admit that, they might be lying a little bit to themselves. I think also that I feel like memoir kind of has some sort of lesson to it, and I was not interested in kind of like explaining what this means to me now as much. There's the letters from the future, but in general, I didn't really want to explain kind of how this all feels now. It was just kind of like the feeling of being so disoriented by what you're going through at the time. So kind of doing it as a novel seemed like readers might be willing to not have the explanation and the lesson.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you're not a fan of the big takeaway. One big message that we're supposed to take away from it.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
So I'll scratch that off my list. How did the bipolar disorder manifest itself?
Similar to this, of course you can't cover everything, but the things that were really alarming were the auditory hallucinations and the visual hallucinations. It's pretty much impossible to not feel crazy if you're seeing and hearing things that aren't there. And then the lack of sleep, that was awful.
Yeah,
I've had sleep problems even going back to it when I was a little kid.
You mentioned the auditory and visual hallucinations. Can you describe and give us a kind of an example of what those
were like? I mean, it was a lot of, it wasn't very interesting. It was a lot of like ringing phones and buzzing sounds and kind of like whispers. And then the visual was pretty shadowy types of things. And then there's a scene in the book where she sees skulls coming out of the wall. And that was based on what had happened to me in class, which was very alarming if you're sitting in class and all of a sudden you start seeing skulls coming out of the wall. So,
yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Juliet the Maniac. And if you could set it up, that would be great.
Okay. So Juliet has been dealing with small everyday teenage issues, and then her bipolar symptoms are starting to manifest themselves and she's having difficulty managing. So she wrote a letter for her parents and they took her to a therapist to try and get the issues addressed. And she was put on medication. They didn't know this in the 90s, but apparently putting juvenile patients, particularly bipolar juvenile patients, on antidepressants puts them at a risk for suicidal actions and thoughts. So she'd been placed on antidepressants about 3 weeks before this attempt. The other thing took over, pushing me into the bathroom. I watched my hand take out my medicine, Tegretol, Wellbutrin. The pills poured onto the counter in a neat pile. It didn't seem like enough. I walked into the kitchen, the tiny cupboard where my mom kept the vitamins and headache medicine. There is a big bottle of Tylenol from Costco. There's a smaller bottle of Benadryl, too. I set both of them down on the counter. I grabbed one of the kitchen chairs. I dragged it in front of the fridge. There is a bunch of liquor bottles on top. I grabbed the gin. I stepped down, got a tall glass. I poured the gin into it until it was full. I didn't put the bottle back. I took the glass and the pill bottles and went into the bathroom. I poured the Tylenol and Benadryl out next to the other pills, threw all of the bottles in the trash. They look pretty, the white of the Tylenol and Tegretol mixed with the bright pink and red of the other pills. I grabbed a handful, shoved them in my mouth, swallowed them with the gin until it was all gone. They went down my throat so easy it was like they belonged there. I went into my bedroom. The lights were off and the room was very dark. I lay down on the bed. My eyelids grew heavy and I closed them. Everything felt thick and dumb. I think I fell asleep. I dreamt I was tied, my hands behind my back, my feet together. Someone had lit me on fire. The flame that burned me was very white and very hot, but it didn't hurt. I couldn't see anything else but flames. I lost place in my body. I became the fire. And then my dad was shaking me. I opened my eyes and the fire was gone. He was sitting on the bed over me. It looked like there were three of him. My mother was over his shoulder. There were three of her too. Her face glistened. I think she was crying and the tears glowed, brilliant as stars. The next thing I knew, I was in the car. My mother was in the back seat with me. My face was against the window, the glass cool on my cheek. She kept on saying my name over and over, her hand grabbing my arm. It seemed too difficult to answer her, and so I didn't. We were on the freeway, and the other car lights went by in streaks and blurs, like lines of fire.
One of the things that's really striking about your writing is the pacing. You managed to include these very vivid details, yet you still maintain this unrelenting narrative propulsion. How do you decide how much detail to include in your sentences?
I mean, that's kind of a tough question. It's like I am thinking very much about the effect that it will have on the reader, and I do care a lot about the way things sound and kind of like the musicality almost of the sentences. Like I can tell, at least what I kind of require when I consider a draft done is that it feels as though the words are kind of bouncing off each other in a weird way, like almost like a musical beat.
Mm-hmm.
If it seems like a more unusual feeling that I'm trying to describe that maybe most people haven't felt, maybe spend a little bit more time there to kind of slow it down so people can really understand what the feeling might be like. But I do really like doing description.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of weighing how important it is that I'm describing versus page space.
Right. I read in an interview where you talked about you don't see the point of describing things like hand gestures.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want your writing to be as short as possible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, not so short that there's no description. And yeah.
And
yeah.
I do also enjoy kind of whittling away. Like that's one part of writing that I think is really fun, is just trimming as much as I can possibly trim.
I'm sure that's easier than coming up with new stuff,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You're writing about life experiences that happened half a lifetime ago, 20, 23 years ago. How are you able to tap into these old memories so effectively?
Well, I think a lot of it is we all have stories that we tell other people about ourselves and we tell ourselves about ourselves. And so a lot of times those memories will stay fresher. And it's almost like, are you remembering that event or are you remembering the retelling of that event so many times? I also kind of feel like I still have a teenage girl side to me, which is sometimes not good. And so just kind of tapping into that side of my personality that's kind of judgmental and insecure, or, you know, the stereotypes we have about teens.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also just very hard to forget how strange the whole situation was of just being completely overcome by something you don't understand at all and like seems like it's coming from nowhere, but it's from inside your own head.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you said you don't have a good memory for facts, but you have a good sensory memory.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, I don't remember much about my biology classroom with the skull hallucinations, but I do remember, like, well, at least I think I remember exactly how that felt. Just kind of, like, the terrifying feeling of that and just feeling like a freak.
Yeah. That's a really good tool to have, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not very useful when I try to remember the movie I saw the other night.
Yeah. You obviously gave a lot of thought to the structure of Juliet the Maniac. You've included patient logs, letters, newspaper clippings, letters from the future written by the adult Juliet. Why did you want to include all these other elements in your book?
Well, the ones that you mentioned, the found objects or documents or whatever you'd like to call them, and then the letters from the future, both of those were pretty instinctual. Like, I didn't think about them too much. I just had, like, wanted to put them in. But then in the editing process, it was like, what is this doing? And so kind of asking myself, what purpose does this serve? And then I was able to come up with enough reasons for both that I let them stay and kind of played around with those the way you might edit anything else, expanding here and cutting there and that type of thing. But I felt like the one thing I just think is odd is that there's not more pictures in books in general. Like, it doesn't seem like it would be out of the question in terms of technology, and we are such a kind of a visual way we process the world with social media and the internet and that type of thing. So why not put pictures
in
books?
Yeah, absolutely. It was great the way you used those too. Well,
thank you.
In her review of your book for The Atlantic, Rosa Inocencia Smith writes that by including these additional elements, readers are immersed in the girl's state of mind, but can also see what her experience looks like from the outside. Is that something else you were going for?
Yeah. I mean, like she's definitely an unreliable narrator, which is A, she's a teenager, and B, she's mentally ill and uses drugs. And so just kind of some sort of alternate perspective. But the adults in her life aren't always reliable either. But I do think it kind of gives you an alternate perspective of what she's going through.
Yeah, it was a real smart move on your part.
Well,
it's very
you.
Effective. Well, one of the most poignant scenes, in my mind anyway, in your book, occurs when Juliet is staying at the therapeutic boarding school, Redwood Trail School. Mm-hmm. She has this conversation with one of the employees named Rosie. I'd like you to read an excerpt from that part, and please set it up, if you don't mind.
So after the second suicide attempt, she gets sent to this, what is called a therapeutic boarding school. And so it's a little bit discipline-based, but mostly the focus for the kids is things like doing farm work and nature activities. And then also they have group therapy and regular therapy. So she's been here for a few months. And this is a bit of a turning point for her.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Rosie was married to a truck driver named Denny, but I hadn't really considered what that meant. Turns out it meant she was alone a lot of the time. Her kids were alone a lot, too. The oldest, her son, had to be the parent sometimes. He put the others to bed when she worked the night shift, prepared breakfast in the morning, made sure everyone got to school on time. She said she felt loneliness in herself, but it was worse when she saw it in him because she knew it was her fault. But I have to look at the positives, she said. Denny's gone a lot of the time, sure, but we have good health insurance, a nice home. Plus, with him being away so much, we don't have time to argue or get bored with each other the way most people do. I swear his job is what's kept us going for these 15 years. She put her fingers on her hairsprayed curls, twisting them in a way that was almost girlish. You know, there's good in everything, she said. It's just sometimes you have to dig a little harder to get it out. She was quiet for a bit, and I was too. Now you, she said. She reached across the table to hold my hand. Hers were warm and plump. Mom hands. You're sensitive, and that means extra pain, extra loneliness, extra sadness. But it also means extra joy. She said, your job is to dig for the gold. God's given you a shovel. You just have to figure out how to use it.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a powerful moment because Rosie is showing tremendous faith in Juliet's ability, despite her current situation, Juliet's ability to find some happiness in the future. And I'm wondering, have you yourself been able to find the extra joy in addition to the extra pain, extra loneliness, and extra sadness that you've experienced in your life?
I mean, it took a really long time and like lots of work, but I feel really grateful to have had these particular troubles, like with the bipolar disorder and the addiction, because I feel like it has given me an appreciation for things that I might not have otherwise. So I do like kind of like the effect that it's had, but it took a very long time to kind of get there. Just being able to enjoy really simple things like maybe the way that the sky looks on a particular day or spending time with my friends or whatever it is. In a way, I don't think I would have been kind of forced to stop and think about things and really try hard to find things out of life that I love and that make me happy.
Mm-hmm. Was there something that happened, some sort of turning point that you can point to? That
getting sober helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did the thing where you sit in church basements with other people. You know, you really have to work hard if you want to be okay with that. But I think mostly it was kind of a slow progression and getting better at doing things like therapy and asking people in my life for help. And it's odd that I think that therapy is a skill and you don't know that skill when you first start in, which is often when people need the therapy to be effective the most, when they're kind of at that crisis mode. But over time, learning how to kind of make that work well for me. But it's been kind of a long, slow journey.
I'm a huge fan of Sparks, so I was delighted to discover that you included their song Angst in My Pants for a soundtrack that you curated for your book. What is it about Angst in My Pants that you like?
It just feels kind of jittery and uncomfortable, but also like there's a happiness there too. The mania I felt at this point in my life was very different than the type I felt as an adult, and it was what a doctor would describe as mixed state. So it's like you have a lot of depressive symptoms in addition to the, you know, generally associated with positive symptoms of mania. And so I like that song because it sounds like sort of happy and energetic, but also discomfort.
It's that combination, exactly. Yeah. Julia Escoria, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Juliet Escoria is the author of Juliet the Maniac. Find out more about Julia at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Chuck Klosterman, Javier Grillo-Marx-Watch, and Juliet Escoria. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You poor dumb son of a bitch. You've done more damage than you know.
Our executive, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I picked you for the job not because I think you're so darn smart, but because I thought you were a shade less dumb than the rest of the outfit.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You don't know who you're dealing with! Don't ever tell me what I can't do, ever! This is destiny.